House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the counter rally for reproductive justice on Saturday, January 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. On the 46th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, this rally is in support and solidarity with all people who have considered, are considering, or have received abortions. It is a protest of the Rally to the Oregon Right to Life March and will celebrate our victories in imagining a future where every person has access to the reproductive health care they want and deserve. Again, that's the Counter Rally for Reproductive Justice on Saturday, January 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square on the southwest corner at Morrison and Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this hour of programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grindel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside and A Street in Portland. Offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch, Grindel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. For more information on Grindel's, you can go to their Facebook page or by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550. And The Radioactivist with Lisa Loving starts now.
It's 9:01, and you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. That's KBOO Portland, and this is The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm here with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand.
Good morning.
Today, we had an hour of interviews and conversation with a couple of different activist groups, and one of them's maybe late. So we are, first we were going to planning on talking with the Portland Parents Union, but we are going to start out instead with Unite Oregon. Unite Oregon is an incredible nonprofit organization that last year, actually, 2 years ago, worked with the legislature to pass the Oregon anti-profiling law, groundbreaking law. Now, Unite Oregon is really digging into the hate crimes issue, how to support people, how to create systems to deal with that. And we're live on the line with Seemab Husseini. Seemab, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about your work at Unite Oregon? What's happening with the hate crimes issue there?
Well, we are part of a task force with the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum. And the statewide task force has a mix of various components to it. We have community organizations. We have law enforcement officials on the same task force as well. It's a bit of a unique blend and mix, but it allows us to be able to still position ourselves as those who speak for the community and have been known to speak up to authority, and be able to put the Attorney General to task on addressing hate crimes as an issue and trying to push proper legislation that will address our communities fairly.
So on Monday night you had this event that was a listening session. Mm-hmm. What happened? Talk about it. How many people came and what were their stories? What did they share? And Attorney General Rosenblum was there. So tell us what happened on Monday night.
Yes, it was very strong and impactful. It was standing room crowd within our Unite Oregon offices, and we hosted the Attorney General with her hate crimes task force, and we had almost 30 testimonies of victims of discrimination of hate deliver their stories directly to her in a format that was very compelling because we had pretty much everything that speaks on how this issue has affected immigrant communities, refugees, people of color, Black, Native American, and really grind into exactly how the systems of oppression has been set up and how the best way to knock this down is by being able to compel the Attorney General by listening to these stories and understand why it's so important to be able to push proper legislation.
The interesting thing about that is that I attended a Unite Oregon event that was also a hate crimes listening session. I feel as if it was in 2017. And one person who came and shared stories was a person who was really severely physically disabled. And the stories that he told shocked me completely. Like how many people that are wheelchair bound, how many people with really severe different kinds of disabilities get harassed randomly all the time. The issue of hate crimes, it impacts us in ways that we don't even always see all the ways. But if you just tuned in, this is The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm here with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. We're live on the phone with Seemab Husseini from Unite Oregon. We're talking about the listening session that Unite had this week around hate crimes. We already heard Seemab talk about it a little bit. It was 2 hours long. It was standing room only. And the actual big guest there was the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, with her hate crimes task force. Suzanne wanted to ask a question, Seemab.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what kind of things people talked about and if the nature of hate crimes has changed recently.
What are the stories, Seemab?
Yeah,
what'd you hear?
Give us some sense of what people talked about.
Well, you know, the stories are all too familiar, actually. I mean, it's not even a generalization. In addition to stories of being racially profiled at places of businesses, businesses that refused services, physical encounters. Many people spoke over all these broad and ranging issues. People for having an immigrant background, a white woman who is a Muslim convert who wears a hijab and has been racially has been profiled simply for being a Muslim because of that. And that being a shocking encounter for her because, you know, she had been a person of privilege up until the point of conversion. So very enlightening things, and they were very broad and ranging that went through these stories.
See, are we seeing new kinds of hate crimes?
Do you think that there's more hate crimes now than there were perhaps before Donald J. Trump was elected president, Seemab, do you think?
Well, so this is the thing, right? Statistics and numbers are out. We have, I think, well over, according to the report that was put out by the FBI, that there's almost 150 hate crimes in the last year, which means that it was a 40% increase. But here's the thing with that number. These numbers are highly underreported. There are systems that are not in place that even allow. I think there's over 170 law enforcement agencies in Oregon, and most of them are not collecting data on bias incidences and hate crime. Eugene is doing a fantastic job here at Portland United Against Hate, which is a coalition organization of us organizations that are putting together tools to be able to make sure we can track and report hate crimes. These are things that are being worked on, but we don't have systems in place across the state of Oregon. As far as the nature of hate crimes that are currently taking place, it's not about the changes. It is absolutely of what type of hate crimes are taking place because they are happening one way or another. And the frequency has definitely increased, but we are looking at a highly underreported number. For instance, Eugene takes up half of that reporting. I think of almost 150. Half of those come from Eugene, but it's only because Eugene has agreed, as a city and as a local police out there, to accept hate crime and bias incident recording. So can I ask, as a natural reaction.
Why are hate crimes underreported?
You know, that's a magic question. We can point at and be suggestive of things, but we just know that it works. For instance, with the city of Eugene, it works with the way what we're putting together with the coalition with the city in Portland, Portland United Against Hate. But it's just being able to make sure that this can become accepted systems through Portland Police Bureau, through other police agencies, that there be an accepted practice of collecting data. I can't speak on why law enforcement agencies won't pick up on doing something that is an obvious fix to an issue. But here's the thing, the fix works as this. If we can account properly for bias crimes and hate incidences in every city, then we can account for solutions that can offer a long-term fix towards these communities and the community members within these areas that are being affected.
I would like to speak to that. This is me, Lisa. I worked with Unite Oregon a couple of years ago. One of the major reasons people don't report hate crimes is because they don't want to talk to the cops. There's a place where hate crimes and profiling, for a lot of people's experience, are connected. So when you have a law enforcement systems that people don't trust, because also, I mean, some of the people who are impacted by the hate crimes may not have all their papers. Okay, so if you have someone, we've seen people in the city of Portland who were driving down the road, minding their own business, and some abusive man, this has happened more than once, has followed their car, harassed them. They don't want to call the police because they're afraid they're going to wind up in a bigger soup than that. So some of these issues are linked, and that's why it is hard to say, well, it's this or it's that. It's all the systems. And I do want to jump in and say, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving with my friend Suzanne LeGrand. We're on the phone live with Seemob Husseini from Unite Oregon. Seemob's in a vehicle. He's actually arriving at the radio station. At some point in this show, we're going to go to music while he comes in and sits at a chair, because honestly, we're interviewing Seemob like he's the organizer at Unite Oregon, but I'll tell you what, he's got a lot of amazing experiences, bigger experiences, and we need to tap into his mind, because basically our goal here is to get you active on these issues, to make you understand that you can have an impact, right? This is a tough one too, isn't it, Seemob? So, you know, Suzanne, you were going to ask another question. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yeah, you said that there's a connection between reporting and being able to take effective action to prevent hate crimes. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. How does that work?
And if you're talking on your cell phone, walking into the radio station, that totally works for us, Seemob. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm about to do that. I mean, the thing is, with everything in systems, to be able to make sure that we're providing ways for community to heal from systems that have been placed for years. There's a lot of repair that needs to take place for communities. Those that are affected are African American communities. We can't address any of these repairs without having proper information, solutions, and data that can take care of these. How we establish mental health systems and access to better education and access to better mental health, and what those programs look like. Things that go much farther and beyond even myself. Right. When it comes to these things. So that's the reason why we need to make sure that basically collect data. Your law enforcement, collect the information. You know, there's far too many of these incidences, these hate crimes, these bias incidences that are taking place to be swept under the rug. Sooner or later, the saying exists because eventually it just becomes a very big guttural mess. it starts to collapse and implode upon the identity of the city. It affects those running the city. It affects law enforcement, and these are losses. These are not wins for a city. These are easy wins for the city to be able to say, we can collect this information. We'll take in reporting. We'll understand exactly the difference between an incident and a report, and understand exactly how to disseminate this. If it's Eugene, for instance, what they do is if it's an incident, their office of equity and inclusion the city will take on that data. If it's a report, then the police will take on that, and they'll build a case from there. But either way, the affected community member will have resources.
Right, right. And I think that's probably the most important thing. We've seen so many of these cases pop up, and most of us don't hear about most of the cases, because what we hear about is stuff that surfaced in our Facebook or on the news, right? And by the time something surfaces in your Facebook or on the news, people might be dead. And it's interesting, Seema, you know, when you talk about that. You know, Portland Police, God bless them, they've had a sheet, a page on their website for years about how to report a hate crime. And the FBI takes hate crime reports. Who else does? I feel like ProPublica takes hate crime reports. The Oregonian did for about 10 minutes a couple years ago, this thing where you could report to the Oregonian your hate crime information. And now I'm forgetting, somebody else did too. And the question was, where does this information go? What's done with it? Some of it goes and sits on a shelf. When I was interviewing the people at ProPublica, I actually thought that they were writing stories about the hate crime reports they got. But what they were doing was they were creating a database so that if local reporters wanted to, they could see if there were hate crimes in there. And when you have like five different places that someone could report their one hate crime, it's exhausting, right? So, I mean, if you're someone who has been followed down the street by a white man in a car who's pretending like he's shooting you with your fingers, you need a trauma therapist, right? So all these things. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me what happens the few times that the hater, I guess, the guilty person is actually caught and prosecuted, because there are laws against a lot of these activities, C-Mob. It's just, C-Mob, I just have to say,
I do have a question about, okay, so the police, the FBI, local agencies, I guess, are collecting this information. What does happen to it after it is reported?
So at this point, it's how it gets used. It goes, I know Southern Poverty Law Center collects data. FBI, they're willing and open to be able to collect this data and this information as well. We have, for instance, like, you have our city council, you have our political processes that take place. You have a person like Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who's just been elected on board, who's able to see systems. You have Sushila Jaipal, who just got elected into Multnomah County. And so within these systems, you have elected officials who are in charge of overseeing exactly how homelessness is addressed. We had people who are speaking on issues of hate crimes who were affected because they were homeless. Homelessness is not a protected
one of the categories.
Class. Yeah. It's not even a category. So because of that, we find data, we find systems, and we're able to say, yes, homelessness should be included as a protected class. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we can consider them as victims of hate crime, and also establish systems of care that protect people that are homeless and not criminalize them.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So it's creating, kind of reflecting the reality of the actual hate crimes. That's part of what you find out.
Correct.
I think that a thing that I find really interesting about this issue is, again, how many different places the information can go, how hard we're making it for people who are surviving and enduring these these incidents? Like, who should they be telling? And if they even call the police or if they call somebody, are they actually safer or not? And here's CMOB at the door. We're bringing in, this is live radio. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is the real deal. We're opening up the door of Studio 2. Here's CMOB. What an incredible guy. I'm going to hug him. Hold on, everybody. I'm hugging CMOB. Thanks for coming. Hey, by the way, this is the Radio Activist. This is the show where you begin to understand that you could be sitting in Studio 2, because KBOO is an activist organization as well. We train people in radio. It's free, y'all, okay? But anyway, you're listening to the Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving, my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. Now we have our awesome live guest, CMOB Husseini, right in front of us. CMOB, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me again.
You just get to mess around with your microphone. This is live radio. Now, CMOB, you're here live in this room. I first kind of met you a couple years ago before you worked at Unite Oregon, and it was because as a human being traveling down the street,
yes,
you saw people who were experiencing hate crimes. You were motivated. Can you talk about that? When did this issue just really land on you?
So, you know, I find myself being an organizer. My primary drive is working with the Muslim community. You know, I'm a Muslim individual myself. I grew up in Los Angeles, there was a lot of color, a lot of diversity, a lot of problems that took place in Los Angeles, but a lot of inaccessibility. You couldn't necessarily sit down with your congressman or your district senator as easily discuss issues. There's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of lines to cross, a lot of hands to shake before you can even get to that kind of access. And, you know, moving up here almost 10 years ago, I saw a Muslim community that was small, but that didn't have a lot of protection when it came to civil liberties. I know that growing up in Los Angeles, at least we had that. If we couldn't access our politicians, we had numbers on our side. And because of that those numbers, we had systems and organizations that were there that were ready to speak out for us. Very long established type stuff taking place there. On a ground level, we were able to be part of activism. You know, treaties between Bloods and Crips was one of my entry points into activism when I was a kid. And being up here, seeing a large valley when it comes to civil liberties and civil rights for Muslims, and trying to understand exactly how it should work out here, getting to know who Casey Jama is, who is the executive director for Unite Oregon, and then just kind of building on from there, that opened a lot of doors. That allowed me to be able to say, okay, if there's going to be a way to work with the Muslim community, find a way to inform them, protect their rights, teach them about what they can do to make things a little bit better. There's a lot of us that are sheltered, but since the Muslim ban, that's even taken them and put them in the limelight. And so with a lot of these issues coming up, especially with this administration, it's been an emboldening time for a lot of folks. It's been an emboldening time for a lot of the rhetoric that we have to fight. But at the same time, it's been a good time to be able to just get everybody circle the wagon, so to speak, and be able to talk to our Muslim community about immigrant and refugee rights, about their civil liberties and how it's being affected, and exactly the systems in place and the things that we can address to be able to fight back. Mm-hmm. That's what got me into it.
So, question for you, how is it that you do mobilize to fight hate crimes, both within communities and also maybe in the larger community?
And I want to follow up. I want to say, tack this on. I know Casey Jama, I know you, and people text you. They call you with what's happening.
Yeah.
That's the system, okay?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's running everyone. I mean, that is grassroots, but
right.
I mean, what can you do? That hurts you too.
Well, being in here, you're not a lone organizer. I work with Unite Oregon, and working with Casey Jama has been an amazing experience to be able to grow as an organizer, work with organizers such as Yaneli Rivas, Christina Palacios, You know, within
Yay,
our
Nelly,
own organization.
Woo!
Yay!
Sorry, that just came up.
You know, we just got a field director, Sushma Raghavan, who's an absolute rock star. We have a development director in Conley. But these are within just within our four walls, right? It goes beyond that. We have an office in Rogue Valley with Virginia, and we have not only just within our own systems, but then we have organizations that are doing similar work for their communities. You know, you have Khalsa, you have Apano, and you know, you get together with all your organizations. And as an organizer, I love building a link and a connection with organizers within our communities, because then we can talk about a topic, we can understand exactly how we're going to approach this, have a similar voice to be able to approach our individual communities, and then when time comes, bring them together in coalitions such as One Oregon, where One Oregon came together and they discussed long-term plans and solutions to being able to address IP22, which morphed into Measure 105, which was threatening our sanctuary status in the state. And as a coalition, as a group of organizations, we're able to basically win that battle. It was a fantastic battle. It was a great school, and it was a great lesson on not just being an individual organizer, working within your your four walls, but also working and using your four walls to leverage your community, but then knowing that you're not alone because the template's being laid by partnering organizations addressing their communities. So that has been a fantastic school.
So if you just tuned in, this is the Radio Activist. We're live now, currently live in Studio 2 with Seemav Husseini from United Oregon. And you were talking a little bit about your work. One of the things that gets me about the hate crimes is that you're literally talking about threats, face-to-face threats. But the groundwork that Unite Oregon has been doing is legislative. It's dry. Mm-hmm. You have to do this dry policy written on a page, and you have to figure out a way, and I'm not going to get all my feelings. That's not true. I'm in all my feelings right now. When you have your Monday night session and you invite people in, and they share the pain of their heart in front of politicians and bureaucrats, that's a mega leap of faith. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're making it safe for people to have a leap of faith there. And I just wonder if you can talk about that a little bit. Like, there's a place where there's blood and there's weeping, and then there's a place where we're suddenly in the legislature. It's like, how do you bring those things together? And that's where the listening session comes in.
Yeah, exactly. We are, again, like I said, we are in a very fortunate place where we can reach out to our senators, our congressmen. We can reach out to our attorney general.
And who's responding? Who's on your team there? We want to know names. We do.
They all are. Senator Wyden's office, you know, they have
done... What about the Republican member of Congress? What is his name? Greg Walden. Has he come to your events? Does he support the work you're doing?
No, he's not come to the events. But, you know, I think there's more that we can even do on our part to reach out as well. I'm not here to disparage, a politician or whatnot. I think that there's... that they're addressing their constituencies, and that's the reason why they exist. That's the reason why they're there. It's being able to reach their constituency, better inform them, and hopefully change the scope of politics. Mm-hmm. There are several things that that can also work for us. If we can't speak to Greg Walden, we can speak to potential candidates that can run for these seats that are often barely challenged even within our own communities, and make sure that we're planting the seed that, okay, listen, young girl, young boy, person of color, background, in faith and hope, you have the ability to be able to lead for us eventually.
It's because the other big thing that Unite Oregon does, and I'm pointing my finger, and that's not polite, is the pilot program. And
yes,
I know that's not your baby, but the really huge thing that Unite Oregon does is a big leadership training program for I'll say newcomers, yeah. immigrant refugee communities. And it never ceases to amaze me. You know, mm-hmm. we see Portland, we see Oregon. It's a Klan state. You know, it's very white, but there are people here from all over the world.
Yeah.
There are people here who have gone through unbelievable things. And it's not good. It's not yeah. fair to erase people. And if we pretend like the hate crime thing or the profiling thing isn't real, that's erasing people. Can you talk a little bit about how far away people have come to Oregon? I mean, just share with us.
So
who's in your community? Because Unite Oregon is a membership organization, y'all. Okay.
Well,
but who's in your community that you support?
Yeah. Well, you know, we are an immigrant rights organization, so the people that we are here to address and protect are immigrants. You know, Casey Jama, who is the executive director, is a refugee. From Somalia, and he came out here and became an executive director of an organization that's there to protect and give back to the path that he had to travel himself through heavy experience, fleeing for your life and knowing that many other people are having to do the same thing. So we speak on immigrant and refugee rights. We have experience with the Somali community because of our work with Casey Jama and his work. We have an association with the Muslim community and that identity. There are organizations out there that also focus on Latinx communities, and we partner with them. But yeah, our primary identity has always been based on immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers, and making sure that their rights are addressed.
So I have a question. Apart from some of the legislative work that you do, how is it that you work with communities to deal with the kind of hatred that has been, you know, hurled at these communities? I mean, this must be really difficult to live with day to day. What do you tell people as to how to deal with this or how to be resilient? Is there something you say?
Well, it's getting them to be able to feel like they can actually speak. So one, providing a platform where victims of hate, victims of discrimination can actually find a way to be able to speak about it and identify. This hate crimes task force that came by and with the Attorney General and did this listening session is one of very many tools. Another thing that we like to focus on, as Lisa had mentioned, was we do have our pilot program, which our lead organizer, she's our leadership development coordinator, Yanelli, runs and does a fantastic job. And through that, we also try to reach out to our community members through our leadership development and make sure that we're planting seeds of leadership within these communities by developing power within individuals who see an emerging leadership within them. Mm-hmm. And through that, we're able to tap and broaden our communication within our communities. We have Khan Lee, who's our development director. We're planning to build our C4 out and also start working with training potential candidates to run for office that come from these communities, as we had addressed. So with these systems, we try to create an educational approach to be able to reach out to our communities and offer a place where they can come, not only speak about what they go through and clearly identify with what's brought them here, but also use that as a source of strength and empowerment to be able to not only lead themselves, but understand that in turn can allow their communities to lead as well.
Mm-hmm. So speaking is a big part of empowerment.
Yes.
And also of identifying or having a language to name some of the different things that have happened to people.
Right.
And I'm just curious then, how is it day to day? Like, what is there any way, is there anything that you were able to say to people to, you know, keep them, I don't know, feeling like they can
be the
make
soothsayer.
A difference?
No, again, I always refer back to listening, because through listening, there's empowerment. I've had a few friends that were in the armed forces. We understand what happens when they come back and the PTSD that they suffer. Well, you know, these are young men and young women going out into the field and being traumatized, but the communities that they're visiting have been seeing this trauma and these events unfold for much longer, for years.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just always making sure that there's a place to be able to provide a conversation and talk first and allow the community to lead based on that that conversation. We can identify what they need, what repair there should be.
I need to jump in here because our second guest is here in the building. And what I want to ask CMOB right now is, how do we support your work? How do we participate with you?
Well, for one, we are having Joanne Hardesty. We're hosting Joanne Hardesty next week on the 16th at Unite Oregon to have a conversation with the community. It's a community information session on Joint Terrorism Task Force in Portland. So one, come to that. Come there. Come to Unite Oregon. Go to our events page. RSVP there. Two, donate. You know, it allows us to establish our identity in being able to work on models that are clearly driven for our community and work that comes from within us. Sign up to our sign up. Become a member of Unite Oregon. Donate. Come to our event next week on the 16th at 6 p.m. At Unite Oregon.
Excellent. CMOB Husseini, thank you for being
here.
Thank you. UniteOregon.org. You're awesome. So stay tuned, listeners.
You are too. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Wow. My gosh.
Radio. It's live radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving with my friend and compatriot Suzanne LeGrand and one of my favorite human beings in the entire world. Sheila Warren is in studio too. Sheila, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Yes. I'm looking for my glasses. I can't talk without my glasses.
Well, for me, it's the lipstick. I can't talk without the lipstick. But Sheila, and we can hook up more super specific information. I know you're looking for specific information, but right now I want to ask you, what's been happening with Portland Parents Union? The last time I had you on the air, you were starting these amazing day-long workshops where you're building community to go and support kids in the public schools.
Yes.
So update us.
Okay. Let me think about it. We've been doing so much.
You had national speakers come to a workshop late last year.
Yes,
big deal.
We just maybe 3 weeks ago, we just had people fly in from New Jersey, principals and educators, to come and learn more about restorative justice. So we are always busy trying to build community and build relationships, which I love.
And so part of what you're doing right now, okay, you're doing counselors and cops, pushback, right. Send letters, sign petition, right. Call City Hall. Right. That's ongoing.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. Okay, so I am a part of a group called Dignity in Schools. It's a national coalition that I happened to find when I started Parent Union in 2009, and I was looking for groups all over the country who were doing the work that I was interested in when I started Parent Union. And found Dignity in Schools, which started around the same time I did. And so the first thing we did was go to Washington and lobby around push out, which means, and it's Dignity in Schools coined the word push out, which means out of school suspensions, expulsions, and also we include in school. Or
it's profiling in the schools.
Or sending somebody home 1 or 2 hours and that school system not counting it, that they are out of school and not learning. So that's what we've been doing since 2009. Each year we chose 101 of us groups choose what kind of campaign we're going to have. A lot of our partners are in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, there where they have huge police presence. School to Prison Pipeline started 25 years ago when police were present. We don't notice it much here in Portland, Oregon. Some people didn't even know that we had police presence in schools until recently. The shootings and the school shootings kind of changed people's attitudes about police in school, but we've been fighting for at least 5 or 6 years around getting police out of schools, period, and paying for more counselors to support people. And so that's what we've been working on, is just making sure that that happens.
Counselors and cops push back. I just want to dig into this a little tiny bit. You're basically you got a petition. You're asking people to send letters to the city council,
yes,
and the Portland Public Schools, yes, Board, phone calls as well. Literally, listeners, Portland Parents Union is asking you to be heard on this issue,
yes,
supporting kids in the public schools. And again, we're talking about profiling, right?
Mm-hmm,
you're
mm-hmm.
talking about kids getting pushed out of the schools because there's, I guess I want to say it, like a law enforcement presence.
Yes.
Although it can also happen in the absence of a cop. And
yes,
I want to say this, so I have not had too much coffee today.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just talking in the last half hour about how people report hate crimes as they've got Casey Thomas' cell phone number, or they've got Seemob Husseini's cell phone number,
mm-hmm,
and they know that they want to call an actual human being who's
mm-hmm
going to ride over and
mm-hmm
and support them,
mm-hmm,
and that's what Casey spends a lot of, I'm just saying,
mm-hmm,
it's no business of mine, but
mm-hmm
that's how you work too.
Yes.
People have your cell phone number,
yes,
their family's
do
in a pickle, and they call you up and say, I need you at
yes
that meeting,
yes,
right?
Yes.
This is what Unite Oregon
mm-hmm
leadership does too. They'll
mm-hmm
be with people at a meeting, they'll be with people to help them find services, but
mm-hmm
that's so hard.
Yes.
That's so hard, Sheila. It's
yes
person to person,
yes,
for real.
Yes, but see, if you believe in the system and if you believe in relationship building, then that's what you're going to do. In order to have, this is the problem with us now, we don't sit down and talk to each other. Simple as that. We hear people saying it all the time, but sometimes it's because of fear. You know, if people are afraid of conflict, sometimes it's a lot of things. And so what we try to do is get people to sit down and talk with each other and build relationships. That's key to when you're going in to try to create a restorative place rather than a punitive place. We're fearful of talking to each other. And now we have Facebook and we have all the things that cause that we don't have to talk to each other anymore. You know, 250 words, baby, on Twitter, and that's about it. And so it's about relationship building. When I'm in a circle and we're relationship building, the person that I like the least, when I hear their story, it changes my mind. When we know each other, we're not so hard on each other, and we won't push back as hard. We can start having those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about how racial profiling happens in schools?
Oh,
like
my
what
God
some of the ways are that this
Sheila
occurs?
Sheila, when are you writing the book? When are we going to get
someone
together and you write the book, okay?
A couple people asked me that. I'm a historian in Oregon around the work that I do, and I have people that are writers who've asked me to do it. I, you know, somebody would really have to sit beside me and make me do it. But, you know, the simple thing around racial profiling, just showing up looking a certain way, showing up black, showing up with disabilities, showing up as immigrant, showing up as someone who is gay, or lesbian or queer, as folks call themselves now, if you just show up. You don't have to do anything. Just show up. And the profiling in schools, I think we were the ones that coined, and I'm sure there are other people across the country that we've coined, the racial profiling does not start with the police. It starts when a child starts school.
Mm-hmm. Preschool. There's a major study by, I think it was Yale University, that went state by state and showed how many preschoolers are expelled and suspended. Yes. I had no idea that was even a thing. Suspended or expelled 5-year-olds. Okay, from the school. And it's all to do with, what's the word? It's infractions that are questionable. It's never something specific.
Right.
Judgmental.
Yeah, I'm just curious how this happens in the school. So people show up, right? And what happens? They are punished in some ways.
No,
they are labeled.
You just show up a certain way. You know, we are very judgmental just by seeing someone.
Yeah.
You know, when I walked in the room, I did a test one time with a room full of teachers. We were doing some training, and I said, okay, what was your impression of me when I walked in the room? I'm the only black person in here. What is your impression of me? So you're talking about implicit bias, explicit bias. You're talking about all those things that we have that we are not even aware of because of how we were raised, our environment, what we've seen, what we've been taught. And so our school system is, we have teachers are overwhelmingly white and women. Overwhelmingly. So you are labeled, just think about it, in this country, there's groups of people that are labeled in a certain way, like black folks. Mm-hmm. We're just devious, we're criminals, we're up to no good, mm-hmm. we're ugly, we're this and that and the other. And so that isn't a lot of people, even people who come over from other countries have sometimes an implicit bias against that because of what they see on TV or what they've heard or whatever. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's about that.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand.
I want to be super specific now because there's so much study about this. And you're saying, but what happens? What is it that makes it happen? So I want to read from Subjective Discipline and the Social Control of Black Girls in Pipeline Schools. It's a study. I'm going to read the abstract. Using an intersectional feminist critical race lens, we utilized the education longitudinal study data comparing 10th grade African American girls to white girls, analyzing whether the student was ever held back, teacher reports of problem behaviors in classrooms, and whether the student did not graduate from high school in the 4 years following her 10th grade year, to determine if subjective discipline, that's the issue, subjective discipline and social control of black girls leads to eventual school dropout.
Okay.
And onto that, I want to add, one of the smartest young African American male human beings I know grew up in Lake Oswego. And when he was in elementary school there, his kindergarten teacher or first grade teacher, when it was reading time, took him and the Hispanic boy, put them in a corner with blocks, and gave everybody else the reading lesson. And this young man has written about this experience. Mm-hmm. His mother was an educator in the Portland schools, and when she found out that his teacher was doing that, she put the kibosh on the whole darn thing. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about subjective discipline, talking about subjective by the teacher mm-hmm. and administrators, subjective decisions about how smart that person is. Did the person do well in a standardized test? Right? That's a big one when it comes to school pushout, is these standardized tests. And now, I know this gets me all hot. Like, it gets me mad. And I have to visualize my mother so that I'm not mad, because I can't be angry and have my mom in my heart at the same time. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit about the current Portland Schools Board. Because when it comes to school pushout, there's the immediate classroom, but there's also the administrator. So somebody has a conflict with the teacher, right? Then where does it go? To the administrator. So talk about that issue.
The Portland Schools Board?
Please. The administration.
The administration?
And the board.
Oh, okay.
Leadership at Portland Schools.
I have to confess, as parent union, what we're trying to do is move away from that system and push. Families are pulling their kids out of school and doing homeschooling. There's a real push for a cultural learning system is a real push for that. And so I know we're moving away from, we don't believe in going into a burning building and begging for 3 minutes, a school board or...
Because you can only talk 3 minutes
or a superintendent that doesn't have our interest at heart anyway. Mm-hmm. And what the school does and what the system does and what institutions do a lot, and I'm getting upset too, Lisa, what they do a lot is they will bring in a token. We have a brown man who's doing the superintendent work now.
At Portland Public Schools.
Mm-hmm. We have a brown man that's doing that. And he is, and sometimes the white folks, I'm sorry, will put up brown men and black men and women in the front and then tokenize them and have them do the evil deed, which we believe the superintendent is doing. He's doing the evil deed right now and doing some crazy, harmful stuff in the system. The system is not for us. The system is made for some people say white supremacy. We say colonialism. We say all this. The system has never been anywhere. Here in America, it's never been for those folks who come in as black and brown. And I can say as a black person, we didn't want to come here in the first place. We support, you know, we come from the slaves that were brought here, with no will to come here. And so we have to recognize that too. We have to tell our history because we are not the victims, but we people have to recognize the history of some folks in this country. And thank God we have activists and folks who support that. Like we support anybody of any color who's been going through something in this country. But we'll have people who are, we sit down with one of the school board members in the past when we were trying to decide who we were going to elect in parent union. And the first thing he brought up was Irish. The Irish went through the same thing as black people, he said. And so we shut him down. The parents shut him down. We shut him down because, whoa, wait a minute. So when you speak of the school board, most of the school board I know, I've worked with in the past, some of them have been worked with or supported parent union. And I know their attitudes. We cannot, you know, it's... Why would you ask me what my opinion was? All you have to do is look at them. Look at who's there. Who's there? They don't look like me. They don't look like most of us. The board does not, I don't care how much they care. They can never, never make a decision for black and brown kids.
Now I want to change.
Or poor white kids even too.
Right.
So yeah.
You know, Ron Herndon will always be the one to say poor white kids in Portland public schools actually get some of the worst scores, and their parents don't. We don't ride on the district. I'm
right.
Saying that. But how about, I feel like, is it in Gresham now where there's three women on the school board and they're agitating for social change? Have you followed that at all?
I don't really follow too much the boards in anywhere.
Yeah.
I follow enough to make sure I know the politics for what we need to do for our families and our movement.
But what if you as you're rebuilding mm-hmm. this environment, right? Mm-hmm. What is your vision? What's in your mind? Like, what can we do to help you? What's in your mind?
I think it's, I don't know. I'll probably be dead and gone, but what's happening, what we've tried to do years and years ago, you know, my age is where I've seen, where I've been a part of the integration movement, you know, I was a part of that. When I was integrated, you know, when the bill was signed and then we had to integrate. Some of us didn't want to, but we had to integrate. We had no choice sometimes. And so my vision is how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And all I'm saying is how you build is you build those relationships. I will tell anybody you will build those relationships. You might be my enemy, but by the time we sit down and talk and tell our stories, we'll be in a different place. We might not agree with each other, but we will be in a different place. And so for me, that's the piece around, you hear a lot of people saying it, you see a lot of it on Facebook. Why can't we get along? Yeah, well, what's the intent? How are you going to get along? We can speak it all day long, but are we going to talk it and walk it? And so my thing is, we've had great movements by just sitting down and building those relationships and sitting down and understanding and trying to sympathize with what somebody is going through. And that's what I would say. That's why we've always done since 2006. I sound like a politician now, right? Since 2006, those relationship building circles, feeding people, talking to each other from all walks of life, all ages and all colors. And I think that's the key. We have to know each other. When people tried to put us together, when diversity, the word diversity was real popular, when they tried to bring all of us together who were black, brown, and, yellow and oh yeah, we'll bring all the colored people together and support them that way. And I'm like, how? That's not logical. We're all tribal. Why would you bring, you can't, we don't get along. We don't know each other. Why would you do that? It's a lot of things that people try to do in the name of us getting along or politics or whatever is trying to figure out how they can bring folks together rather than asking the folks if they want to be brought together. It's just like our parents. Do you ask the parents anytime when you make these decisions? Do you bring in the experts, the students and the parents to help you to make those decisions? We've been in a school where a principal has said, well, we're gonna change this. We're pushing for classes with special ed kids to allow parents in there with their special ed child. You know, those are classes with the, they don't call them, they call them special ed classes, but because of the confidentiality of FERPA laws, in classes like that, you have to be very careful in letting someone in, like a parent, who just wants to be there with their child and help to add and do some training and help to make them feel safe. But they are not allowed to be in there because of the confidentiality with other kids in the class.
That's wild. The HIPAA
yes.
law.
Wow. Yes.
I never,
yeah,
that's
and
wild.
I say FERPA, it's HIPAA, but FERPA is something else. But yeah. And yeah, so you wow. if you're not on the ground seeing that or a part of that, you don't know all these dynamics that go on. So when you talk about push out, that's one way to push out a child. That's one way when you are you use these confidentiality excuses for everything. We pushed back on the school and said, you hide behind that. There's ways that we can get as a community, get to those families that need our support and help. I hope I'm making sense.
You are.
People
yeah.
use mm-hmm. all kinds of different ways in the system to keep folks out, and that's push out.
I want to follow up on that and say, when you say people use different ways, I see that sometimes there's individual people who are doing that, and then there's the system
yes.
that facilitates
yes.
it. And one of the yes. things that blows my mind the most over the past 2 years is how many teachers in Portland Public Schools have been sexually abusing students, and people have talked about it for years, mm-hmm. and it just took years for anyone to give a damn and mm-hmm. do something about mm-hmm. it, which gets me. But I want to come back to you, Sheila. It does sometimes, public education, we've never done it right in this country.
No.
We've never done it right. And it feels a little bit like climate change. What can we do? It
yes.
seems impossible. And yet, breaking it down to smaller tasks, I mean, mm-hmm. is always a thing to do. For people who are listening now, what do you want them to do to support our kids in the schools and to support your work?
Okay. I just want, when we ask, show up. That's simple. We ask all the time. And you don't show up. You're sympathetic with what we do, but you don't show up unless it happens to you. I'm trying to think of something else, but that's basically show up when we ask. And we're always asking. We're on Facebook. You can find us. We're always inviting and asking. We're trying to create a community support piece, a community piece where all of us can come together and try to figure that out together. When we talk about busyness, that's our worst enemy is busyness.
Right.
Hmm. Our yeah. worst hmm. enemy. And we need to take that word and spit on it and throw it out the window and throw it somewhere and use something else. Because busyness is our worst enemy. And we use that as an excuse for not supporting. I'm too busy also. But how do we make sure? Because if we started supporting each other, some way that'll take away that busyness in some way, because we're doing a lot of supporting. It's a critical mass of people supporting mm-hmm. each other. Critical mass.
Sheila, we're running out of show. We're at the top of the hour, and we have to wrap up. And we've talked a little bit about how people can show up. Mm-hmm. People can find Portland Parents Union on Facebook. I never want to encourage people to go to Facebook, but
no.
if you're there, go to the Portland
yes.
Parents Union. Click on what they're doing and participate, okay? I just want to thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another way that they can reach you besides that?
You can call my number, 503-880-9145. Yeah, people are panicking around here, but yeah. it's out there. That's so you can call that number, and it's parent union number. It's also my cell. And if it gets too crazy, I'll change my number. All right. Simple as that. But all right. Anyway.
So I want to say thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you.
Participate with Unite Oregon at uniteoregon.org. Mm-hmm. We just said Portland Parents Union as a website, portlandparentunion.com. They're also on Facebook. I want to thank our engineer, Heather. Theme music by Ms. Deluxe. The KBOO volunteer coordinator is Ani Haynes. Radical inclusion is her game. Contact her and be a volunteer at this station. Volunteer at KBOO.FM. You could be behind this mic. We are radioactive. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Don't leave me here a twist in the wind.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, kicking off 2019 with Americana Music Quartet True North. The show is January 18th, 7:30 p.m. at Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. True North is fronted by award-winning singer-songwriters Kristen Granger and Dan Wetzel, and rounded out with two well-known Northwest bluegrassers, Martin Stevens and Josh Adkins. Kristen Granger has won recent awards from Telluride, Merlefest, and Kerrville Songwriting Competitions. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, member-supported community radio for all of Portland and Portland metro area. Up next is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein.
Today on